Welcome to Obesity, a Disease, the official Obesity Medicine Association podcast exploring the many facets of the disease of obesity. In this episode, obesity medicine specialist and OMA clinical education director, Dr. Nicholas Pennings, interviews Dr. Harold Bays, OMA chief science officer and a speaker from Overcoming Obesity 2020 virtual conference, about anti-obesity pharmaceutical agents currently under development. Obesity, a Disease podcast is brought to you by the Obesity Medicine Association, the clinical leader in obesity medicine.
What happens when we restrict calories? The physiologic response to a calorie deficit is to increase hunger signals and decrease satiety signals. This is not just a short-term response. It is known to persist for at least a year after significant weight loss. The result is that hunger and desire to eat persist long after weight loss. This is one of the reasons why weight loss is so hard and why weight regain is so common. This is where anti-obesity medicines can play a vital role in weight management. Anti-obesity medicines counter the natural physiologic increase in hunger that occurs with calorie restriction. So today we have a number of medications that we can use to treat that physiologic increase in hunger, with more in the pipeline. And that is what we're here to talk about today. I'm Dr. Nick Pennings, Chair of Family Medicine at the Campbell University School of Osteopathic Medicine and Executive Director of Clinical Education at the Obesity Medicine Association. And with me today is Dr. Harold Bays, President of the Louisville Metabolic and Atherosclerosis Research Center and Chief Medical Officer for the OMA. Dr. Bays did a presentation at the OMA 2020 virtual fall conference on anti-obesity medicines in the pipeline. Thank you for being here, Dr. Bays, and welcome.
Well, thank you very much, Dr. Pennings. I'm going to call you Nick, if that's okay.
All right, Harold. That's
I think we know one another.
So. Yes, we do. All right, go ahead. All right. Well, very good. All right, Harold. One of the perceptions that I find in providers and patients alike is that people who cannot stick with a diet plan are considered to just lack willpower, that they're just not trying hard enough. How do you respond to that?
Well, I try to be nice about it because it sort of drives me crazy. Let's go back to what you said there at the very beginning, because hopefully people were paying attention. Before we eat, there are all these hormones and such that cause us to be hungry. And then after we eat, there are all these hormones that gravitate towards having us not be hungry. And I think that's a very simple equation and simple way to look at the neurophysiology. And I know a lot of people say, well, you're just making that up. And as you said, you know, it's mainly that people just don't have willpower and that kind of stuff. But you know, I don't see it that way. I think the forces that we have in our body that defend against starvation are very, very strong. And the forces that we have to combat overweight or obesity are very, very weak. And that's just not political correctness here. So I will ask you Dr. Pennings. I mean, you have a patient with diabetes mellitus. They have hyperglycemia. You can have blood sugars of 100, 200, 300, 400 milligram per deciliter, very high, and may not know it. But if you get a blood sugar that goes down to, say, 40 milligrams per deciliter, you're going to know it. So hypoglycemia elicits way more of a physiological response than hyperglycemia. And I don't see how it is that we don't apply the same sort of physiological standards to obesity. We defend against reduced caloric intake, but as far as on the upside, the increase in caloric intake, the body just really doesn't defend against that very well. I mean, you're an expert in insulin and such. I mean, what's your sense about that?
Well, I think that's a great analogy, that the satiety signals are not nearly as strong as the hunger signals. And so that, and I also think what's interesting is that those hunger signals are strong no matter what your weight is. You could be a normal weight, you could be 50 pounds, 100 pounds, 200 pounds overweight. You calorie restrict, you create a negative energy deficit, and you're going to be hungry.
Well, and that's right. It's what I call the big yellow taxi effect. I don't know. You remember Joni Mitchell, from the 70s.
I do.
You know, Big Yellow Taxi, you know. Oh, don't it seem to go? You don't know what you got till it's gone. Mm-hmm. So, you know, my sense of it is that I think when people do have the overweight or they have the obesity and they do have increased in leptin levels, for example, or other hormones and such, maybe they're not terribly effective. And maybe you're not feeling that they're doing a whole lot, but boy, you start to lose weight. And if those leptin levels start to get in the normal range, or if they start going below the normal range with active weight loss, that's when you're going to know it then, right? You're going to know when it's gone. And I think that goes back to what you said at the very beginning, that these hormones and such that kick in can really drive an increase in physiological hunger. I don't mean just appetite. I mean physiological hunger. And that's just what some people call a new set point that people have to deal with. And one of the ways that I think people can deal with that better would be through the use of anti-obesity pharmacotherapy.
And I think that part of this is a general perception of that all our decision-making around food is part of a conscious decision-making process, and really ignoring those hunger and satiety signals and the role that they play in regulating our food choices and our decisions when to eat and how much to eat.
Well, and that's right. And again, going back to what you said before, this notion that that people are not motivated and that's what results in increase in body weight. My goodness, Nick, how many patients do you see that come in the office? They're high-level executives, you know, clinicians, you know, some of the brightest people that we know, some of the hardest-working people that we know. Are we to believe that somehow they can be successful, ultra-successful in every other parts of their life, but when it comes to their health, suddenly they lack willpower? Does that make any sense? See, I don't think it makes any sense at all. And so I think, when I'm starting next year in 2021, we'll have the updates to the obesity algorithm. And one of the things we're really exploring in this update is essentially curing obesity in two words: be inefficient. Because at least to me, I think a big reason for the increase in the obesity epidemic is people that have the mindset of efficiency, which would be your successful people, I think that is to their disadvantage. You don't want to be efficient. You want to be inefficient. When it comes to the food being absorbed from your gastrointestinal system, you know, your microbiome and stuff, you want that absorption to be inefficient. You want to consume foods and fibers and such that cause the absorption to be inefficient. You want your skeletal muscle to be inefficient in how it is that it burns calories. You want to burn more heat than you store heat. You want to, here's a practical one for you. So I was, back when I was a few years ago, you know, I walk on the treadmill and do these types of things, and I had to incline up and these things. And I read this article that you can burn off about 30% less calories if you're holding on to the handles. Nick, I was just holding on the handles for no particular reason. It was not a conscious choice, right? And I said, that can't be true. And I let go of the handles, and it's very, very true. So all I'm saying is, I just think there's a lot that's kind of, people that are efficient, they're going to park nearer to their building, right? They're going to find quicker ways to get places and everything. They're going to order from online services rather than go to the store. They're going to have food delivered to them rather than going to the restaurant. And don't even get me started on the mitochondria, you know, all the things about uncoupling proteins and all these types of things. The point I'm making is this, is that the very mindset that caused people to be successful in their lives may be the exact same forces that are working against them when it comes to body weight.
That's right. You know, it really is amazing what a complex condition this is, what a complex disease it is, and how many regulators we have that influence our appetite. So can you tell us a little bit about how the anti-obesity medicines work on this, particularly some of the targets that some of the newer agents that are in the pipeline are looking to impact?
I think the first thing for people to understand when it comes to where are the targets coming from and anti-obesity treatments, you know, surely, I mean, we certainly have the surgical procedures and the devices and such, okay? But I'm not talking about those. I'm talking about pharmacotherapy, all right? I think you don't need to look any further than the Obesity Medicine Association definition for obesity. And that is, obesity is defined as a chronic, progressive, relapsing, and treatable multifactorial neurobehavioral disease wherein an increase in body fat promotes adipose tissue dysfunction and abnormal fat mass physical forces result in adverse metabolic, biomechanical, and psychosocial health consequences. And I think that's just so spot on. And if you look at that definition, where would you naturally gravitate towards if you're going to look for treatment targets? And that would be in the looking at gastrointestinal hormones and looking at central nervous system hormones and neurotransmitters and those types of things. And Nick, that's where we've been, and that's where we're going.
With a lot more efficacy and a lot more granularity in terms of the targets that we're reaching?
Right. And certainly from an efficacy standpoint. I mean, currently we do have say for example, I'll just pick one. Phentermine. I mean, it's a sympathomimetic amine, right? So it works on the brain and such. But then you also have the glucagon-like peptide 1 receptor agonist, and yes, they have central nervous system effects. But these are, I think, a lot of people would consider, originating from the gastrointestinal system and such. They work physiologically, that's where they work. And they have all these sorts of effects, not just on the central nervous system, but also on all sorts of, you know, body processes and such. And those have proven to be quite effective. And the one that's approved is the liraglutide at 3 milligrams. And at the lower dose, it's 1.8 milligrams is for diabetes, but for treatment of the obesity, it's a 3 milligrams. But isn't it interesting that we're in the development of the semaglutide, which is not just an injection, which is what liraglutide is an injection. Semaglutide is in development, currently approved for diabetes, but in development as an oral, okay, as an oral agent, as a pill form. And I find that quite remarkable.
And I think one of the other interesting things is the idea of using combination therapies and targeting those hunger and satiety pathways from multiple different directions by using combination medications.
Well, and that's exactly right. Currently, and that's where we are right now. So semaglutide, as I mentioned, is what we call a GLP-1 receptor agonist and such. That, as I said, it's in a pill form. I know that I didn't get people too excited, but as a clinical trialist, I mean, I've been a principal investigator for over 500 clinical trials. And I know when people look at things like antisense, they're like, oh man, you know, that's really the science is. And it is exciting. And we do those studies and we're happy to do those studies and it's great. But I got to tell you, the idea that you could swallow a peptide and it doesn't get degraded in the acid of the stomach, you know, how can you do that? And make it absorb uniformly and sufficiently so where it could be a marketed pharmaceutical. I find that to be extraordinarily advanced science. I mean, people don't look at it that way, but I mean, that's the way I look at it. I mean, I'll ask you, how many oral insulins are approved out there?
Yeah, zero.
Zero, right? Zero. So, you know, it's not easy to do these things. And that's very high science. It may not seem like it, but it kind of is. But anyway, going back to your point, so I think that alone has got some really interesting upsides, but we also have being, and hopefully we'll talk about why this is, but But now we have this GLP-1 receptor agonist is sort of this backbone. And now we have these combination agents where we're adding things to a GLP-1 receptor agonist. And these are all in development. And I mean, at least our experience thus far looks very, very promising. Very promising.
Well, that's great. So obesity rates continue to rise and affect up to 50% of the population in some groups. We currently have a number of effective anti-obesity medications on the market, yet only a small percentage of patients with obesity are prescribed anti-obesity medicines. Why do you think they're not being prescribed, and what can be done to increase the treatment of obesity as new agents become available?
Well, I'm glad you asked that question. Here's the thing. Okay, Nick. I want you to go back into time, okay? So I started doing clinical research about 30 years ago, and when I got started, it was right when we were developing all the statins. So I've been a principal investigator in every marketed lipid altering drug, most antihypertensive drugs, most diabetes drugs, and when we first started developing the cholesterol drugs, the statins. Back in the day, people said, "Why are you doing this?" I'm like, "What do you mean? Why are we doing this? We want to improve cholesterol, so reduce the risk of people having a, major adverse cardiac event, heart attack. That's why we're doing it." And they're like, "There's no evidence of that." As a matter of fact, statin therapy increases your risk of homicide and suicide and all this kind of stuff, death and all these things. I'm like, what are you talking about? But Nick, do you remember that? At all? Mm-hmm.
Yes.
I did. And it was insanity. But there was always these naysayers. And so even back then, there was apprehension and there was resistance towards implementing statin therapy when they were first being developed. And you could say the same thing about antihypertensives. And you could say the same thing about insulin. There were major academic institutions that were discouraging people from using insulin because they said, there's no evidence that using insulin is going to help anybody. And you ought to just let people have hyperglycemia so they can, urinate out the calories. I mean, this is what people were thinking. I mean, I know it sounds ridiculous now, but at the time we had prior to statins, prior to the ACE inhibitors, prior to the ARBs, prior to the these newer diabetes agents that we have, prior to the metformin and the newer insulins and these types of things. We had drugs like in the lipid space, we had what we called fire and sand. So we had niacin and resins, bile acid sequestrants. And that was not pleasant for patients. And then on the diabetes side, what did we have? We had pork insulin, right? You remember that? We had NPH and regular insulin and such, and people would have reactions and lipodystrophies and these types of things. And it was just a mess. And don't even get me started on the antihypertensives. I mean, methildopa and all these kind of crazy drugs, and people were depressed and feeling terrible and everything. But then when we developed these drugs that were much better tolerated and much more effective, and then what was the single biggest event that turned all these drugs that nobody were convinced that were needed until they became standards of care? What was the major thing that took place? It was the results of cardiovascular disease outcome studies. So you asked me, why is it that there has not been the uptake in anti-obesity pharmacotherapy? And I would tell you, this is nothing new. I will tell you that this is, you talk about deja vu. I mean, I feel like I felt 25 years ago. It's the exact same thing. Until we have safe and effective, and what I mean by effective is promoting the kind of weight loss that doesn't just improve the metabolic parameters of the patient, but something that the patient believes is clinically meaningful, okay? Once we get there, and Nick, once we get cardiovascular outcome studies demonstrating cardiovascular disease outcomes benefits, then as opposed to them not being prescribed hardly at all, they instantaneously become standards of care. And so to answer your question is, it's just that we're behind on the science. And that's the simple reason why it is that there's not this uptake. I mean, I'll just ask you, if you knew that there was if you knew that we had two or three or maybe four anti-obesity agents out there that were going to be promoting a mean weight loss of 10 to 15%, and all three or four of them had cardiovascular disease outcome studies to support benefit in reducing major adverse cardiac events, do you think there would be increased uptake of these treatments?
Yeah, I think that would be a big boom to the field and change the perceptions around the treatment of obesity. You know, I also draw a parallel to the treatment of depression. Years ago, depression was blamed on the patient. It was, you know, just kind of snap out of it, just be happy. The medications we had at the time were very poorly tolerated and had to be prescribed by psychiatrists. And then we developed an understanding of the role of serotonin and norepinephrine and dopamine and its effect on mood and depression and anxiety. And then a safe and well-tolerated medication came out. Prozac became available. And suddenly I wouldn't say suddenly. I think we saw a steady then shift away from the idea that this is just something the patient is doing to themselves. And instead, that we now understand there's a physiologic basis for this, and we have a safe and effective medication to treat it. And I think that became a big boost for the treatment of depression and anxiety as well. And hope to see the same kind of parallels with the treatment of obesity as these big medications become available, as their efficacy increases, as their tolerability increases. I think that can create a lot of opportunities for treatment of obesity.
Well, right. And then in addition to drug treatment for depression, there are all sorts of behavioral modifications and things that people can do. And the same applies with regard to the obesity, right? Because it's a multifactorial disease. So going back to taking it full circle back to what you said at the very beginning, isn't obesity simply a matter of lack of willpower? And the answer is absolutely not, for the reasons that I mentioned. And for those people who are geared towards efficiency, I think it will take, even with the introduction of more effective anti-obesity agents, it's going to take some sort of education, some sort of a reaching out to patients and say, look, it could be that a good part of your increase in body fat and everything is just how you're wired from a, not just from a physiological standpoint, but from a behavioral standpoint, which, oh, by the way, probably related to one another, right? They're probably integrated. It's not like, you know, one is separate from the other.
Right.
So I guess my point is, just as with the depression example that you gave, I think the same holds with regard to obesity. I think it can't just be the drugs, although I'm telling you, the ones we're working on, major departure from other drugs that we've worked on in the past. So for the people that are wanting hope, trust me, help is on the way. These are, again, major difference in what we're seeing. But it's never going to be, it will never be, that the treatment for obesity is solely going to be based upon drug therapy. There's going to have to be understanding appropriate nutrition. And as I said, being inefficient, understanding the impact of ultra-processed foods or the caloric densities of food, understanding physical activity and what that means. And how it is that just some modest exercise on a daily basis can make huge differences in people's health and in their lives and such. And then just some basic behavioral modifications. Sometimes I think that's undervalued. I think there's some basic things people can do. We talk about, you know, non-exercise activity thermogenesis. You know, how people, as I mentioned before, if you're walking up steps, don't hold on to the handles of the steps, you know, on the sides of the steps, unless you're doing it for balance or whatever. There's just some basic things that people can do in their lives that can make big differences. And yes, drugs are going to be able to help, and they will help, but they're never going to be the entirety of the solution.
That's right. And along the lines of the discussion, stigma and bias is an issue that is common with respect to obesity. Stigma and bias by family, by healthcare providers, and perhaps most commonly by patients toward themselves. Recently, lorcaserin came off the market due to some data trending towards an increased risk of cancer. I read several editorial viewpoints that discuss the increased risk, cancer risk with many other medications that are on the market, especially medications for treating things like insomnia. Yet those are not pulled from the marketplace. Do you think there's an inordinately low tolerance for complications for anti-obesity medicines? And perhaps this reflects a bias towards anti-obesity medicines in the approval process?
Look, I know people, you know, a lot of folks would like for me to agree with that, but I'm probably not going to agree with that. I mean, look, I'm not denying there's not bias, and that is true. But what you're talking about, at least from my perception of where the question goes from a perspective of a clinical trialist such as myself, is the following. Do the risk of the drug exceed the benefits, right? Do the risks exceed the benefits? And if you have no data, zero data, to suggest that anti-obesity drugs promote increased longevity, then the minute some anti-obesity drug has a signal, in this case, lorcaserin, you know, had a cancer signal, whatever, then I think, yeah, I think there's going to be a low threshold that the regulatory agencies are going to take it off the market. And that's the point I'm trying to get to. Folks, have hope right now as we speak. You know, just this morning, we're managing patients who are in cardiovascular disease outcome studies with regard to anti-obesity agents. And Nick, that's what I'm trying to say, is if these studies prove benefit to patients from a cardiovascular standpoint, oh, by the way, the number one cause of death among certainly older individuals with the obesity, then the world changes. It instantaneously changes. And now I think these thresholds that you talk about, I think the calculation becomes very, very different. But until we have definitive clinical trials showing definitive clinical benefit, I think you're going to find some reluctancy of keeping drugs on the market that even have signals for adverse effects.
So do you think that, I mean, there's so many other medications that wouldn't necessarily impact cardiovascular outcomes, you know, such as treatments for insomnia. So is it being held to a higher standard than it should be?
I don't want to get too weedy here, but you know, the approval of drugs and keeping on the market, non-market, they're under different parts of the agency, the Food and Drug Administration, and I guess what I would say is this. Look, I got no relatives that work for the FDA here, okay? I mean, I'm a clinical trialist, so I got no, you know, conflict of interest here, okay? But what I'm saying is this. If we make the argument that obesity is a metabolic disease, which I believe that it is, then I think you naturally say then, okay, then the drugs to treat the disease, the best place to go to look for analogies would be other metabolic diseases. And that would include the diabetes, the hypertension, and the dyslipidemia. And so I guess that's the prism by which I'm focused on is looking at it within that context. And I'm not really looking at it from the context of is it altering people's sleeping? Are they sleeping better or sleeping worse? Or you know, that sort of thing. I'm looking at it from the context of obesity as a metabolic disease, and if we're gonna say it's a metabolic disease, then I think we ought to hold the treatments to the same standard as the treatment with the other metabolic diseases, and that's exactly what we're doing. And hopefully, within a few years, this conversation we're having here today is going to seem really, really outdated.
Well, I certainly hope so, because it's a high bar, right? It takes a long time to get to that point to see cardiovascular outcomes.
It does, but. but it has to be done. Okay. It's a moral imperative, not just a medical imperative. It's a moral imperative that if you think about it, if 67% of the adult population has overweight and obesity, right? I mean, this epidemic, people talk about COVID and everything, but obesity, and based upon the number of people on the planet, I mean, you could make the case that obesity is the greatest epidemic of all time, right? So why don't we have safe and effective treatments from not just from a surgical standpoint, but from a pharmacological standpoint? And I guess my retort to that would be, we should have. The studies we're doing today, we should have been doing 20 years ago. But look, we're doing them now. We're moving on it. And hopefully we're going to see the same sort of favorable results. Look, some of these drugs are very close to, if not identical, to the drugs that are proven to have cardiovascular disease benefits in patients with diabetes mellitus. And oh, by the way, we used to think that treatment for type 2 diabetes mellitus with anti-diabetes drugs did not reduce the risk of cardiovascular disease, right? It wasn't just until a few years ago that now we have the GLP-1 receptor agonists and the SGLT2 inhibitors. And now suddenly everybody just accepts the fact that anti-diabetes drug therapy is going to reduce your risk of cardiovascular disease. But that wasn't the thinking up until just a few years ago. Then the world changed for diabetes. And I'm just saying, my prediction here today, hey, Dr. Pennings, my prediction here today is that, 3 to 5 years from now, we're going to look back and not even remember why we were in the situation that we're in today, because I think it's going to be totally different. The world's changing.
Well, I think it's very exciting research, and very excited that you're participating in that and leading a charge in that direction. I think that's being very visionary, and look forward to seeing the outcomes of that. I just want to close with one last question. Is when talking with patients about obesity, what is your favorite piece of advice?
My favorite advice is to go to exactly what we've been talking about here, is to explain to people that obesity truly is a disease. So if a person comes in and they don't have the diabetes and the hypertension and the dyslipidemia, and they come in 20 pounds later and now they got all three, Nick, that's not a coincidence, right? It's not just some, wow, I mean, how odd that those would go. No, because then what is the clinician going to advise to the patient to do? See what we can do towards reducing the body fat. And why would you make that recommendation? Because everybody knows that there's likely to be an improvement in the diabetes and the hypertension and the dyslipidemia. So clearly there's a connection there. Clearly, what has happened is when you put on body fat, your fat becomes what I call sick. You get sick fat, or the adiposopathy. And I think that's a very easy way to explain things to patients. Say, look, whenever your fat cells get to be too big, or whenever your fat tissue becomes too big, it's like if your heart got too big. If your heart gets too big, it doesn't work very well. And it's the same thing with your fat. Your fat's a very active metabolic and immune organ. And if it gets too big, it just doesn't function well, and it promotes the diabetes and the hypertension and the dyslipidemia. So we want to treat that sick fat. And one of the ways we can do that is we're going to shrink that down. And we're going to do that through nutrition, physical activity. We're going to do that through pharmacotherapy, maybe bariatric surgery. We're going to implement behavior modification. We're going to do all of these things. We're going to take the all of the above approach. And when your fat cells and your fat tissue become healthier, you're going to see an improvement in all these other metabolic diseases. And I just think that's this whole sick fat, healthy fat type of thing. I think that resonates with patients and makes it a lot clearer. And it sort of nails down how obesity is a disease.
And I love that term, adiposopathy. It really, I think, describes the situation very well. Well, thank you very much for being here, Harold. It was a pleasure talking with you today. I really enjoyed this conversation.
Absolutely.
And for those who want to learn more about anti-obesity medicines in the pipeline, you'll find Dr. Bay's lecture on the OMA Academy. Thank you very much, and it's been a pleasure talking with you today.
Appreciate it.
Thank you, Drs. Pennings and Bays. For more information about obesity medicine podcasts and other resources from the clinical leaders in obesity medicine, please visit www.obesitymedicine.org/podcasts. Loved the episode of Obesity, a Disease? Head over to iTunes to subscribe, rate, and leave a review. The views expressed in this podcast episode are those of the show hosts and do not necessarily represent the opinions, beliefs, or policies of the Obesity Medicine Association or its members. Please check back in soon for another episode of Obesity, a Disease.